It's Wednesday, May 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams reporting from Washington. Coming up, Osama bin Laden's secret letters are released by the U.S. government.
Most of this information appears to be communications among al-Qaeda leaders and affiliates in places like North Africa.
We look at the humanitarian impact of the bombing in Yemen. And comedian David Letterman prepares to say goodbye to his long-running hit television show. It's all ahead. The U.S. government has released scores of documents it said were recovered during the 2011 raid in Pakistan on the compound where U.S. forces killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. The material released Wednesday included a variety of declassified documents, personal letters to members of bin Laden's family, a list of English language books recovered from the compound, think tank studies, software, and other technical manuals, and material published by other militant groups. VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke with Seth Jones, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation.
What is the significance, in a broad sense, of the release of these documents? Typically, the intelligence community hasn't given their documents to the public. This time, they're doing it. Why?
Well, actually, this is part of a broader effort over the past several years to provide additional information about the way al-Qaeda's operated. There were documents released from this trove a few years ago. There have also been a number of documents released from al-Qaeda in Iraq. Many of them have gone to the counterterrorism center at West Point. These ones, though, were released directly on the Director of National Intelligence website.
Is this any sort of a tectonic shift? Normally, you know, for years, the intelligence community held on to every scrap of paper. Is there something that has changed in government operations or in the way the DNI is operating to facilitate this?
Well, look, we're living in an age where there's more access to information. In many cases, documents get released without the government's direct involvement. They get leaked in the case of Edward Snowden, for example, or with the WikiLeaks documents. In this case, these are documents that provide us a glimpse of the inner workings of al-Qaeda from its senior leadership, from Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and other senior officials. What they provide in this sense is transparency in how the organization operated. Now, it is important to recognize that this is only a very small tranche of thousands and thousands of documents from the trove captured at bin Laden's complex. So it's important to keep that in context and looking at these ones that are released.
We don't know what these documents are at this point. I mean, obviously the people that have the documents in front of them do, but we, meaning the public, don't. What if there are, for instance, documents that show cooperation or collusion by various governments or various actors or entities? This is kind of interesting because in releasing these documents, might there be some embarrassments?
Well, I haven't seen anything along those lines in these particular documents. There may be that kind of information in other documents that have not been released. Most of this information appears to be communications among al-Qaeda leaders and affiliates in places like North Africa. They discuss issues like the Arab uprisings and how to take advantage of them. So these are really, most of them are strategic-level documents not implicating neighboring governments, with the exception of some interesting information on some of the al-Qaeda affiliates that were and members and family members that were in Iran.
What is the public's benefit by this release? I mean, the average Joe on the street, Is there any takeaway to this, or is it just a matter of transparency?
Well, I think it is important to understand an organization that continues to threaten the United States and the West more broadly, and not just the West, but also threaten a range of countries in Africa, in the Middle East, South Asia, and the broader Asia-Pacific Rim. The rise of the Daesh, or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, there are a number of other organizations, in addition to al-Qaeda, that are providing a threat. the more we can understand these kinds of organizations, I think the better educated the population in these various areas can be. And what you really gauge, frankly, is that this is a social movement that's not going to go away anytime in the foreseeable future. And that's what people should come away with in understanding.
Do you think because of this release that we'll see any follow-on releases? You say that there are literally thousands of documents involved. So once we get through this first tranche, can you expect additional documents to be released that also came from the same raid in Abbottabad?
I certainly hope so. There's a lot more in there. There's a lot more context that those documents can provide on everything from how Al-Qaeda was able to live and establish sanctuary in Pakistan, relationship with individuals in Pakistan, with Iran, involvement in strategic dialogue, operational, tactical level details. A lot of that, I think, is helpful in understanding the organization that the U.S. and a range of other Western countries still have to deal with. I don't know whether the U.S. government is going to release more, but it should.
That's Seth Jones of the RAND Corporation. He was speaking with VOA's Jeffrey Young. Well, now it's time for our social media segment, and we're joined by Michael Lippin. Well, Michael, how is social media reacting to the news of the release of these bin Laden documents?
Well, I can tell you about Twitter. Twitter analytics website Topsy says bin Laden, the words bin Laden, have been mentioned in 25,000 tweets in the past day. It's quite a lot. I've been looking at some of the most prominent tweets on this topic. One of them comes from a digital media website called Mashable. It tweets a link to its story focusing on how Osama bin Laden was worried about global warming, too. Another tweet comes from U.S. television network Fox News. It tweets a link to its story called Bin Laden's Bookshelf, New Documents Reveal Inner Workings of Terror Group. Another U.S. TV network, ABC News, retweets a post from its investigation team. It says ABC investigates the books that Osama bin Laden was apparently reading before his death. Now, the Washington Post has more on that. It tweeted about the books that we now know were on Osama bin Laden's bookshelf, and they include Chomsky, Woodward, and 9/11 conspiracy theories. One more tweet to tell you about. This is from business and technology news website Business Insider. It tweets that 2 years before his death, Osama bin Laden believed that his war against America was only halfway finished. Sarah, back to you.
Very interesting information. Thanks very much, Michael. That's Michael Lippin.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the Internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. UN aid agencies report the humanitarian impact of the nearly 2 month Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen and a blockade of fuel and other imported relief supplies is enormous. The agencies are appealing to the warring factions to agree to another ceasefire so essential aid can be delivered to the beleaguered population. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN aid agencies are taking stock of the situation in Yemen following a recent 5-day humanitarian pause to allow for the delivery of life-saving assistance. They say they are extremely troubled by what they see. They say the few days in which the guns fell, more or less silent, has allowed them to view the extent of suffering being endured by hundreds of thousands of citizens displaced by the conflict. The UN Refugee Agency has revised its displacement figure up upwards from 300,000 2 weeks ago to more than 545,000 now. The death toll also has gone up over the past 2 months of escalating fighting. Latest United Nations figures put the number killed at 1,849 and the number wounded at nearly 7,400. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says the temporary ceasefire agreed to by the Saudi Arabian coalition and Houthi rebels has allowed aid workers to access areas that had previously been off limits.
What we found were traumatized populations, people afraid, upset, and struggling to meet their basic needs. In the Amant al-Asimeh area of Sana'a, we interviewed displaced people staying with host families where several households were crowding under a single roof with inadequate bathrooms and water supply. Fuel shortages make it difficult to pump water.
Many people were economically vulnerable before the crisis. Now, Edward says, they are even worse off. He says most have lost their livelihoods and are entirely dependent on aid. He tells VOA the severe shortage of fuel in the country due to import restrictions on commercial and humanitarian aid continues to be a critical issue. He says the lack of fuel is compounding many existing difficulties.
It's pushing up prices. It's making it difficult for people to get about. The amount of fuel we were able to bring in is really only a drop in the ocean of needs, approximately 10% of the amount of fuel needed in the space of a month. So you can see there's significant need to get more in.
The UN Refugee Agency reports the humanitarian pause made it possible to fly in more aid and transport supplies to distribution hubs in the capital Sana'a and Aden. It says in-country stocks of relief items now are 3 times higher than they were before the pause. However, it notes checkpoints, insecurity, and high transport prices make it difficult to move about and distribute aid to the people in need. The World Food Programme says it too is experiencing similar difficulties. WFP says it had planned to provide food to nearly 750,000 people during the humanitarian pause, but it was only able to reach 400,000. It says it needs more time and more security to help those in need. The agency is appealing for what it calls a series of predictable breaks in the fighting to be able to deliver food to the hungry. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America.
Here are the headlines from VOA. The U.S. government has released scores of documents it said were recovered during the 2011 raid in Pakistan on the compound where U.S. forces killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. U.S. President Barack Obama says that global climate change poses immediate risks to the country's national security, increasing the possibility of natural disasters and humanitarian crises. Islamic State fighters seized parts of the ancient Syrian town of Palmyra Wednesday, sparking fears that the militant group would destroy a priceless archaeological site. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said Wednesday that international inspectors will not be given access to the country's scientists or military sites under any nuclear deal with world powers. And 5 of the world's largest banks face around $5.7 billion in penalties for illegally colluding to manipulate prices in currency exchange. I'm Bob Doty, VOA News.
Coming up, comedian David Letterman prepares to say farewell to his long-running television show. China's heyday as the world's factory is fading, and to try and address that and other challenges to the world's second largest economy, China has unveiled a new plan that aims to transform the country into a manufacturing power. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
Made in China 2025 aims to address what a report on the topic that was issued this week calls the huge gaps that exist between China and advanced industrial nations and the reality that the country can no longer rely on low-end manufacturing and exports to fuel its massive economy. It also aims to move China higher up the manufacturing chain by focusing more on innovation and cutting-edge technology, outlining 10 key sectors where the country hopes to make advances over the next decade, from information technology to new energy vehicles, robotics, and high-tech ships. Klaus Meyer, director of the China-Europe International Business School's Research Center for Emerging Market Studies in Shanghai, says that through the plan, China is trying to keep up with developed countries on the one hand while making up for its own gaps. He says that as the cost of labor rises here, China is under greater pressure than other emerging economies to upgrade its economy and create more value-added labor.
There are fewer young laborers available. Therefore, labor costs, especially in the urban centers such as Shanghai, are increasing. And in consequence, the model that China has pursued over the last 30 years, which had a major element of export-oriented production based on low labor costs, will not be sustainable.
Chinese Premier Li Keqiang approved the plan, which focuses on some of China's biggest problems, such as its lack of high-quality goods and strong international brands. It also aims to tackle the inefficient use of resources and energy and the development of green manufacturing to address the high cost the country's environment has paid over the past few decades. Raymond Yong, a senior economist with ANZ in Hong Kong, says the document provides good direction to promote China as a brand, but whether or not the government can carry that out remains to be seen.
And obviously we need the government to open up the market for foreign access and to allow the private sector to take a larger role in the economy and in different sectors. So deregulation remains the key, and the document itself has not touched that in details.
Yong says that such measures could come later, though in the form of announcements from other government departments such as the National Development Reform Commission. China's state-run Xinhua News Agency says a slew of policies to deepen institutional reforms and strengthen financial support will follow to help support the plan, which will be market-oriented but guided by the government. While some industries may need government support and funding for research and development, Yong says that allowing the market to play a role is key for innovation. He adds that the government decision to cherry-pick 10 key sectors is worrisome and could be risky.
What the government actually needs to do is to cultivate an environment and to allow the market to promote different industries when they see fit.
Hu Xingdou, an economist at the Beijing Institute of Technology, says that while the plan is a good broad outline of how to transform China from the world's factory into a manufacturing power, he is concerned about how little attention the document appears to give to private enterprises. Hu says he worries the effort may end up putting too much focus on China's large and less nimble state-owned enterprises. Hu says promoting private enterprises and developing an entrepreneurial spirit is key. And entrepreneurs breed innovation. And to breed innovation, you need private enterprises. Those who are in charge of state-owned enterprises are not entrepreneurs. They are administrative officials, he adds. Made in China 2025 is just the first phase of a three-stage plan. China aims to be a manufacturing power on par with other major powers by 2049. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
From the heart of Broadway, broadcasting across the nation and around the world.
That sound is the opening to David Letterman's long-running TV show. Tonight, after 33 years, the comedian is saying goodbye to his fans and to television. VOA's Adam Phillips in New York joins us a few hours before Letterman hosts his final show at the Ed Sullivan Theater. Adam, I understand you've been down by the Ed Sullivan Theater, and you talked to some Letterman fans.
Oh, yeah, I was there. I was there this morning. Everybody was outside sort of anxiously hoping for tickets. Of course, tickets to the last show are going to be very, very difficult to get today. But, you know, people felt very sort of bittersweet and nostalgic about it. And I spoke to this one guy from D.C. down where you're from. He'd come all the way up here to get tickets. His name is John. You want to hear what he had to say?
Sure.
Sad to me, I'm 38, so it's really like a loss of a part of something that's been a part of my life almost since I remember TV. He had a knack to play off things, and it was slapstick, it was sarcasm, it was cynicism. So all these kind of off-the-cuff things that his humor could just say anything and play off anything. Kind of was cutting edge back in the day. Nothing else can really fill the void for me.
Okay, so that was him. And another guy felt it much more personally. He was younger than John was, but he also felt kind of sad about the whole thing. He was waiting for tickets, a nice guy with a backward baseball cap.
I really think he kind of created this unscripted sense of late-night television. And I feel like so many late shows today are so scripted, and you can tell they're scripted, and I think that just takes away from it. And I don't know, some of these people I feel like hold themselves at such a higher level, and with him, I feel like he's kind of like the common guy and like a father-type figure, just like a friend, you know. He is a New Yorker, and he encompasses all of that.
Yeah, that was the thing about Letterman. Everybody, critics and audiences alike, liked his spontaneity, like the fact that he was a regular guy. He didn't like show business too much, at least the culture of the whole thing. And so, you know, there was sort of a real feeling of the passing of an era, to use a much-used cliche. But not everybody felt bad about it. One guy wanted to wish him the best, Robert McDowell, and I'll let you know what he had to say online.
Yeah, he's been doing this over 30 years now. I think it's time for him to move on. I'm pretty sure there's a lot of things he wants to do with the rest of his life. He's up in age. He has a son, a very young son, and he wants to spend time with him. And he's done a good job over these years. He's got a lot of fans. I'm happen to be one of them.
Are you trying to get tickets today?
Yeah, I wanted to congratulate him on his retirement, and I also want to say thanks for the memories. Plenty of memories there. So yeah, we're gonna miss him. I'm pretty sure everybody else is gonna miss him too.
All right. So that was kind of the scene outside, and it really is a big day. I mean, Letterman has become a New York icon of his own, and I wish him the best, and I think he gave a little bit of oomph to New York City's image as well.
Yeah, well, that's I think he certainly did, and it's sort of interesting to think that his show in its final years was from that Ed Sullivan Theater, which is so famous as where a number of famous acts, including the Beatles, I believe, made their first American performance.
Right, that was the big thing. I mean, so that was one of the things that people always saw. They always, you know, you always saw tourists snapping pictures of the big late night with David Letterman marquee and the restaurant down the street where he used to do his sort of live cams and all that sky cam stuff. That's stuff that he really started. So I think it is a passing of a moment. And, you know, we're used to change around here, but at the same time, we can sort of shed a crocodile tear ourselves.
All right. Thanks very much, Adam.
Sure.
That's International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns in the strongest possible terms the murderous attack on a bus full of peaceful civilians in Karachi, Pakistan. Wednesday, May 13th was just another workday for many of the residents of Al-Azhar Gardens who rode on the pink commuter bus that morning. As the bus traveled its usual route, six men on three motorcycles pulled up alongside it and flagged it to a stop. The six men boarded the bus and immediately began to shoot the passengers. All victims were shot in the head, and at least 45 of them died. The Pakistani-based Jandala, a Tehrik-i-Taliban splinter group that pledged its allegiance to ISIL, claimed responsibility for the murders. The vast majority of the victims were members of the Ismaili community, a branch of Shia Muslims who follow the Aga Khan as their spiritual leader. The Ismailis believe that the Aga Khan has the authority to interpret the Quran in relation to the present time. They are peaceful, progressive, and non-political. According to Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, the Ismailis are a very patriotic and peaceful people who have always worked for the well-being of Pakistan. But to extremists, anyone whose religious precepts differ even slightly from their own qualifies as a heretic. Extremists see nothing wrong with killing a human being who does not worship exactly as they do. We offer our deepest condolences to the families of the victims. The American people stand in solidarity with the people of Pakistan and with the global Ismaili community on this tragic day. Make no mistake, said Secretary of State John Kerry. There is more strength by far in the respect and solidarity that we feel towards one another than there could ever be in any terrorist attack. The United States will support efforts to bring all those responsible to justice and stands ready to provide assistance to the investigation of this tragic attack.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com.